This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we've enjoyed a fascinating encounter with a group called the Nairichters.
In the early days of cinematography, there was a condition called Krieg Eye. You know, where basically there were things called Krieg lights, and they were so... they were so aggressive, they were so strong, these lights, that the actors actually got sort of damaged to the retinas of their eye. The BBC have fixed the light outside here in the BBC car park in Peachgrove. I'm fairly certain I'm getting Krieg Eye. All we actually need is guards with Alsatians. Seriously, it's ridiculous. I'm Mark Stephen, right beside me here at Beechgrove, cowering under the light. Rachel Stewart.
I'm also chasing after a bag. A bag for life kind of bag. Which we had sticks in up until a few minutes ago. So it's a bit of a carry-on film going on here just
Can
now.
Can I tell you a story about that?
Go on.
My mum and dad were in, I think it was Lidl or Aldi, and the lassie in the checkout said to my dad, would you like a bag for life? And my mum said, I'm here.
Oh dear!
She's quick, my mum.
Isn't she just? I tell you, it's a mild morning, 7 degrees, I think it is just now.
And well, it was 16 yesterday.
16. It was so mild last night, I could have done my evening stroll without my jacket on.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't.
I didn't do it, but I could have done.
You could have done.
You know, it was so mild.
How hot does it have to be before you take your jacket off?
At least.
I've never seen you without a jacket.
At least into the 20s.
You're right.
At least.
Yes.
Yeah.
High 20s, isn't it?
High 20s, yeah. Let us know if you're going to be out and about today enjoying the milder weather. I actually don't know what the forecast is, so I may be seeing that prematurely. I think it's supposed to be okay.
I think it's supposed
anyway.
To be okay.
Yeah. Get in touch, let us know your plans. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or you can give us a call. I think it's Owen here this morning taking your calls on 08085 92 95 00.
We've turned a corner. Not only are we in February, but we have passed Imolc. We've done another corner because we thought it was pronounced Imbolc. This week we discovered it's pronounced Imolc. It's the Celtic celebration marking the halfway point between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. We've got more on that later because the days are getting longer and things are looking up.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic actually, and it's amazing. You can actually see the difference in the amount of daylight now, beyond 5 o'clock, which is fab. And that's handy when you're travelling all over the country as we do. I was in Galloway this week on a fabulous road which you've been on between Lauriston and Gatehouse Fleet, and you go over the moorland.
Yes, it's
stunning.
Beautiful, but it's single track for quite a long way.
It is. I was there late afternoon. There was a lot of pink in the sky, and it was just stunning. Stay tuned to hear about Galloway's bid to have the next national park.
But first, as ever, we've got a mystery sound. See if you can guess what this is.
We don't know if that's all that challenging, do we?
We don't think that's terribly mysterious, but never mind.
It's good.
That's just us. You know, our opinion counts for nothing in this.
Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring, 08085 92 95 00. We like all your humorous suggestions too.
Indeed. Just before Christmas, Sally Devlin got in touch with us to highlight a scheme her family run from their bike shop. Aviemore Bikes is the posh meaning, but everybody knows it as Mike's Bikes. It's a project which allows local residents to give an electric bike a go free of charge for a period of time, anything up to about 6 weeks. I went along to the shop to find out more, and they set out some examples.
On front of us just now, we've got a wee selection of some of the Ace bikes. I guess to give you an idea of what they look like, a couple of them are standard bikes. You might not know it was an electric bike, but this particular one here is called a cargo bike, and it's got a really large bucket on the front, which can fit maybe two children or lots of parcels or whatever you want to put in it.
Weekly shop.
Yeah. And it's still got two wheels. A lot of folks think they might have three, but they're still just like a regular bike.
Okay. And this one here?
So this one here, if you rode past someone, they probably think you're on a normal bike, but it's got an electric motor in it, do about 50 miles, maybe on a charge. You can take it on all the tracks or routes you might take your normal bike, but you can also pop some panniers on it and put in your shopping or work supplies and use it maybe instead of the car or whatever.
The sound of coughing in the background there came from Jazz Hepburn. You were a cyclist? You then had a really bad accident and got onto the electric bike. Tell me about the accident for a start. What happened?
Yeah, well, my cyclocross bike going downhill, a switchback corner. You rode a bit of track and I went off it and did a 360 somersault in my bikes and cleats. Ejected, but landed in the handlebars of my bike. And and I'm not the slimmest of people, as you've noticed. So, a bit of damage. So
yeah. I mean, how much damage?
Four ribs, flail segment, punctured lung, broken clavicle, two rotator cuffs. And a bar to edge in up here.
So why the electric bike?
Well, myself and Ali, my wife, we love mountaineering, climbing and ski touring. And we had the offer from Mike from the community side of it if we wanted to trial electric bikes. And to be quite honest, I'm a bit cynical to start with, I must admit, and he'll know, because I always basically like the effort. However, myself and Ali, I think we had it for 6 weeks or something. And what it did was make it a bit of an eye-opener and a revelation into getting into the hills, going to places we wanted, doing tours in remote areas without the hard work, but with a lot more efficiency and going further than we could.
Yeah,
so great from that point of view.
See, it's interesting, Ali. I've described electric bikes in the past as being essentially time machines. You know, that takes 30 years off you. It does. It increases your range. It allows you to go slightly faster, keep up with the rest of the pack, all of the above. But, that, you know, certainly in the case of Jazz, there must have been a confidence issue there too.
Well, yes. I mean, when I got on it, the first thing I noticed was it was slightly higher, but it was actually heavier than
considerably.
And that sort of... I wasn't expecting that, I suppose. So that was the first thing. But yes, I'm still the same as Jazz, that I like to go out my bike and I like to, you know, get a bit of a workout. But it did open up different areas to us, so a little bit longer. And I actually felt I was cheating a wee bit at times, because if I found a hill, I could just crank it up a notch and it would give me a little bit of help. And then I thought later, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. But it was, I actually enjoyed the 6 weeks that we had it, and I did make myself go out on the bike just about every day to experience it.
And at the end of 6 weeks, did you actually invest?
No. No.
Why not?
Because I'm not there yet. I just like my mountain bike, well, and my road bike, and I just like to go out there and get a workout. So we said never say never, so we might in the future, but I'm still quite keen just to use muscle power.
Yes. Mike, I was actually in your workshop earlier.
Aye.
And I saw for the first time, I've never seen these things before, an electric bike hoist for electric bikes, because they are considerably heavier.
Correct, because the senior mechanic is 57 years old.
Really?
And his poor lower back can't lift 30 kilos every 30 seconds. So we got ourselves a wee electric hoist just to lift them up and down.
Yeah. So essentially what you've got is, you know, if you go into a garage, you can put the car up on the
exactly
ramp and whatever,
the
and up it goes,
exactly,
but it's exactly the same bit for bikes.
And it means ergonomically you've got the bike exactly where you want it to work on it, so they're not bending over. So perfect.
Yeah, absolutely spot on with that. And Sally, this idea of actually lending bikes out to the community, I mean, it could be seen, well, it may be a sales dodge for all I know, but I suspect there's more to it than that.
Yeah, the bikes actually, they belong to what's called the Cairngorms Trust, which operates here in Badenoch and Strath Bay. They've got good selection of e-bikes now, which we take care of. We do the maintenance, we find the people, we look out for maybe new styles of e-bike that might suit people's needs locally, and essentially we facilitate it for them at no cost. People can come down, fill in an application form, find a bike that suits their needs, and if availability allows, they can have it for up to 6 weeks, like Jazz and Alison did. So it's a great scheme to be a part of.
And
As I understand it too, there's a wee wrinkle in this, in that there are bikes set aside actually for National Health Service workers.
Yeah, so recently we added to the sort of, I guess you'd call it the scheme, three e-bikes that belong to the NHS, and again we do the maintenance, help them to kind of identify folk that can make use of them, and they're exclusively set aside for use by folk that work in the NHS locally, and in particular the new hospital in Aviemore, which has brought a lot of employees from the smaller villages into a more central hub, so they're a great asset for those folk to have.
One last question to Jazz and Ali. I'm assuming this is a good area to actually cycle in, you know, and explore further with electric bikes and what have you.
Absolutely.
But on the basis of your experience, if folk were thinking about actually borrowing one of these things, what would you say to them?
Absolutely, definitely borrow it, but keep in mind that you're going into wilderness probably, even if it's in tracks, and just be careful of the environment when you go. The other thing it was great for was, after my accident, was a fantastic tool to get some rehab. I couldn't make my lungs and things work because of ribs and punctures. But when the electric bike came along and I threw my leg over it, then I could actually get some workout, but without the pain and the agony of the injuries. And if I'd done that on my own bike, I wouldn't have been able to get a normal bike. Absolutely. Rehab was fantastic.
This pair borrowed the bikes, Mike,
yes,
and then didn't buy an electric bike. So they're a rubbish example in that regard.
yeah.
But how, I mean, in the normal run of things, if people borrow them, do they end up buying them?
I think the majority express an interest in buying, and I think it's 50% of people actually invest then. So they use the scheme to try the whole thing. And there's actually quite a few have replaced their car with a bike now.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's quite a common thing now because they consider... They can then go shopping on a bike, because the Highland roads are pretty choked up with traffic now.
Totally. And I would definitely buy one when we get the resources and get the means and wherewithal. But I would definitely have one.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, me too. He's not getting one without me.
Alison Jazz Hepburn there, along with Sally and Mike Devlin, of having more bikes.
Yeah, nice idea. I was actually trying to find figures last night about how many electric bikes are in Scotland, but I couldn't really get anything that I thought I could quote here. But there must have been a reasonable increase in the last few years. They were certainly predicting it, weren't they, after lockdown?
Oh, going into lockdown, yeah, there was a huge increase in the number of people that actually bought these things. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get them for love nor money for a while.
No, you couldn't. No, yeah. I remember putting my daughter's old bike, just a push bike, on social media just to get rid of it for free, and it was a wave within about 4 minutes. I kid you not.
It's bicycles, full stop. It's interesting, we passed a place yesterday. It's amazing how you forget. We passed a place yesterday, it's a tiny wee lay-by, and it is exactly 5 miles away from our house. And that's where I parked when they slightly released the restrictions for lockdown, etc. Because that gave me the range to actually get the bike in the back of the car and move further out and what have you. And I never passed that lay-by now without remembering it.
Yeah.
How strange.
Yeah, it is strange.
Now, do you remember, you know, there was a huge public stooshy when that tree, the sycamore gap tree, was felled in Northumberland?
Yeah, massive reaction. I mean, people wrote poetry about it, didn't they? There was a profound feeling of loss, I think, when that happened.
It was just, it was the incomprehensibility of the vandalism, I think, really sort of offended people.
I think so. I think if it had been a sort of accidental thing, people would have got their heads around it, maybe. But
not deliberately.
No, indeed. And I think that probably proves that many people do have deep connections with trees. I know we've discussed that in the programme before. This is something that cellist Jessica Kerr has been honing in on with a project called Stories of People and Trees.
Jessica's been gathering stories relating to trees, and has commissioned some new musical work to accompany those stories. Helen Needham met up with her at Maxwell Park in Glasgow to hear more about it. Now, it seems that for string players, generally, trees are especially significant, given, logically, that their instruments are crafted from wood.
There is both in terms of just our sort of love and connection with our instruments, because we grow up with these beautiful instruments that are handcrafted, and we're very appreciative of the wood as well. Like the front of my cello, the grain is quite wide. It's quite an unusual looking instrument.
What kind of wood
instrument
is it? Do you know? I always wonder that, if, you know, because the instrument is so important and it's almost an extension of you, really, isn't it?
I know. I think the front of my cello is maple.
Right.
But yeah, so we love the feel and the form of these instruments. And One of the stories, in fact, came from a luthier, so that's someone who makes and repairs string instruments, who makes instruments out of iconic pieces of wood. So at one point he found himself becoming the possessor of some of Shackleton's floorboards.
Wow!
So he heard that they were clearing out this property, which had once been the residence of Shackleton, and he found that they were just throwing out the floorboards. So he went along and he's made instruments out of them, and he's made instruments out of driftwood and out of trees that were maybe in a hospital where people were recuperating after one of the world wars, and so real plenty of story in those instruments. A story that I collected at an event, a local event, was from an Afghan girl, and it's ended up with a piece of music written about it. So it's called The Apricot Tree. And she told me just very simply about the trees that were in her yard of her house back in Afghanistan. And it was quite a large house. There were multiple generations of her family living there. And they had a number of fruit trees, including this apricot tree, which was the largest. And so her granddad had built them a swing, and her and her sisters would swing happily on this for many years. And she would tell us also about how much fruit it would actually produce. It just produced so much fruit that they would give it to their neighbours and to their friends when they came to visit, and they would also dry it in the sun, and then it would be able to sustain them through the winter. So it was really part of the family. But of course, she's now living in Glasgow, but she said that her grandfather still lives in Afghanistan, and although they've moved house because the family are all living in different places now, that he still returns. And the way she described it was that it's one of the only things that still makes her grandfather happy and sad, because it brings back all the memories of when the family lived together in their house in Afghanistan. And I just thought that was beautifully poignant, this bittersweet quality to that story.
And that brings us back to the idea that we spoke of or touched on earlier, which is the fact that trees are so long-lived that actually they can have a symbolism that crosses the generations.
We do turn to trees, don't we, when we want to sort of memorialise loss or find some meaning in a difficult time. And like the childhood theme, that has been a theme that's come out of the project. And it's just given me a wee bit more insight into, you know, I'd never really stopped to think before, but it is beautiful to think of growing something for the people of the future. And so it's that generosity. You're doing something to help you remember somebody, but there's a generosity to what you're doing because you're giving to people in the future. You may not ever really expect to see your tree or your woodland grow to full height in your lifetime. There's one of the stories is called Robin's Cherry Tree, and it was told by Jo, whose little baby girl Robin had sadly died when she was very, very little. And Jo was reflecting that initially they'd found the changing of the seasons really difficult, because it was that sense that other things were just carrying on. And the planting this cherry tree had given her a new way of accepting that cyclic movement and of things changing over time and growing after that loss. And so she'd started looking forward to seeing the next stage of growth again.
You mentioned there that thing of planting a tree to give for other people, but you're also giving something to the wider environment as well, aren't you, and for all the creatures and creating habitat.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been fascinating learning a little bit more about woodland ecology. I've been really lucky. Like I was supported by an ecologist, Rachel Hurst, in doing this project because it was not my area of expertise. But also the organisations like the Community Woodlands Association or Reforesting Scotland, I found people to be so welcoming and so keen to help me learn about these things. And yeah, just the beauty of trees is that they support so much life, don't they? And even after after a tree has died, then it's still supporting life. And in fact, it's probably providing some of the most important habitat for small insects and invertebrates that we can find anywhere.
Jealous Jessica Kerr there. And you can hear all about our project, Stories of People and Trees, in the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now on BBC Sounds.
Yeah.
And we've just discovered that our studio producer today, Laura, plays the cello.
Yeah, and here she is. Oh, no. The heart attack. Well,
you can find out more about the trees, stories and music from Jessica Kerr on the project website, storiesofpeopleandtrees.com.
Join me, Nicola Meehan, for a new episode of For the Record.
There was a way to do your own music in your own voice.
My guest is singer and songwriter Eddie Reader.
So I was kind of on my own. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be in a band. I happened at the time to be having a summer fling because I was at a folk club in Findhorn.
Eddie shares the songs that have soundtracked her life and the stories that go with them.
We both realised that we loved each other after knowing each other for 20 odd years.
For the Record, listen now on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, she's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, we've got the revival of a tidal pool in Fife, and I visit a burial ground with a difference in Speyside.
And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have a wee listen.
John Quinn from Millicent says, is it a ringed parakeet? There's a flock of them in Dawson Park, and we saw 12 in a tree at the Forth and Clyde Canal in the west end of Glasgow. I didn't know they'd made it this far north.
No, nice.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Denise and Phil, your Rothes fan club, have emailed in with quite a clever guess, but we're not reading it out because it's too close to the truth. They say, we'll be heading out for a short walk from Glenallachy to the Lynn Falls near Aberlour with our son and his partner, Nathan and Annie. We're trying to convert them to listening to Out of Doors, but they're currently snoozing. Who can blame them? Apparently, we've got two correct guesses so far.
Oh, excellent.
If you've got loads of time to get in touch, if you'd like to have a guess, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or give us a call 0808 529500. Now, back in lockdown in 2020, when Mark was parked up at his lay-by, a seawater pool in
who can forget that?
A seawater pool in the East Nuke of Fife started to experience a bit of a revival. Quite a few of them did. Since then, the Sellardike tidal pool has undergone a bit of a revamp, and more work is planned this year to restore the attraction to its former glory. I met up with the resident who kind of kick-started this whole project. She's Christine Wilson. And I also spoke to Andy Hancock, who's the secretary of the body in charge of it. And he explained the unique layout of the facility.
So the tidal pool consists basically of two elements. One is the main pool itself, which has a seawall on the outer skerry, which allows the tide to come over it, fill it up, and then the water stays in, the tide goes back out again. And then on the inner side of that, there's a small boating pond or children's pool, and that's used for model boat enthusiasts and also young kids when they come down here in the summer months.
It's in such a scenic spot, isn't it? It's not very far from Sellardike Harbour itself, and it feels like it's just been cut out of the rocks, doesn't it?
Well, it has actually been cut out of the rocks. So the natural rock formations are these sort of angled bands of rock that head out towards the sea. And between 1930 and 1933, local volunteers came down here and actually blasted out the central part of the rock here, built a wall on the outer part of it that enabled them to have this depth of pool here, which is shallow at both ends and has a depth of about 6 feet in the middle. And in 1934, they made the middle bit slightly deeper, taking it out to 8 feet deep so that you could dive in off the high diving board. That sadly no longer exists.
Now, it was popular in the 1930s, but like a lot of these attractions, it kind of fell out of favour, didn't it?
So when we got to sort of the mid-1960s, the local council sort of gave it up, and because it was being used less, because cheap foreign holidays and the invention of more indoor heated swimming pools drew people away from it. What we found, though, in the lockdown in 2019 is that with nowhere else to go, and certainly no foreign holidays, that people came back to the pool and started using it and recognised the benefits of both physical and mental well-being. And since 2019, we've seen it almost day on day grow the number of users here from the very, very young to the slightly more mature.
Now, I feel we can't tell this story without speaking to Christine Wilson, because you are the woman who kind of started this whole thing off, aren't you?
Kind of. I mean, I grew up here, but I'm 45, and as a child, for me, the bathing pool, I call it the bathing pool rather than tidal pool, the bathy was in a state when I was young, so that was 30 years ago. It wasn't really inviting for swimming. So I've got a little girl who was 5 years old at the time, and during lockdown it was difficult to find things to do with your children, and we were very fortunate that we had the bathing pool, the tidal pool here right on our doorstep, so it became a place to go.
But it wasn't very easy to access at that time, was it?
No, it was not. The ledge is still there. You can come and see the ledge that we all used to shimmy along. We used to shimmy along the concrete ledge. It's maybe about a foot wide with a 6 foot drop at the side of it down onto the rocks. And yeah, we all shimmied along the ledge one by one, holding your child's hand down the rickety ladder at the end, and had a lot of fun. But the pool had a lot of debris in it. Old creels just naturally get brought in with the waves, and they're broken up when they come in, so they're jaggy, and you know, you don't want to be standing on an old creel. Lots of debris, lots of broken concrete, and just general rubbishy stuff.
And you put a message out on Facebook, didn't you, asking people to come along and give it a bit of a tidy up?
Yes, yes. Just with speaking to people, everyone was like, oh, you know, mentioning things that were wrong, or, you know, somebody's going to get hurt, and I thought, right, let's just try and get something done about this. So I made a wee page on Facebook called The Bathy Makeover, and put a little shout out to ask if local folk would, and strong people as well, because we needed sort of a lot of lifting of stones done and stuff, would come down and have a bash at tidying it up. So bring your scrubbing brushes and your mussels and a cup of tea and gardening gloves. and it was a total success. There was about 40 people came down and brought buckets, and because we filled buckets and buckets and buckets with seaweed that we pulled out. People took it for their gardens. And we shovelled loads of stones out the baby pool to make it a lot nicer for the kids to be in on their little feet, because it was just absolutely covered in rubble. There was people in their wetsuits, in hauling out all the seaweed, and guys in going underwater lifting out big bricks. You know what I mean? It was amazing. Everybody did what they were able to do, and some people just came and watched. Some people brought down a flask of tea, and people brought cakes. Do you know, it was just lovely, and it was the start of this, the start of something that's really amazing.
And Andy, you've got big plans for the future. Tell me about them.
We have been greatly supported by Fife Council over last year, and we've managed to get new guardrails in to make it safer from the roadside car park area so people can't fall into the pool. We've got new guardrails, new steps, more steps coming in the near future. So, yes, we really are trying to make it a safe, secure and inclusive space for anyone to use. We've been very fortunate, having done a full structural survey last year. We have worked out all the things that need to be done to get it back to to as close to its former glory as we can. That is a £176,000 price tag on that work, but we have got a preferred consulting engineer to do the work. We were £100,000 down that road, and we're still looking for obviously more support so we can get that work done, majority of it hopefully this year.
It is such a beautiful spot with lovely views of the Isle of May on the right day.
Yeah, just to see the sunrise over the water with these emblematic chunks of stone and bedrock here, looking out across the Firth of Forth and seeing the Isle of May in the distance really is quite a breathtaking sight, and is certainly good for the soul.
Andy Hancock and Christine Wilson there of the Celadike Tidal Pool, and we'll hear more from some wild swimmers who are regulars at the tidal pool come sleet, snow, rain or shine later in the programme.
Yeah, they are great fun. Just stay tuned to hear them. I love all the noises that they make when they hit the water.
What noise did you make when you hit the water?
Well, I was actually standing there fully clothed going, oh, it's quite cold today, I wish I'd taken my gloves. I wasn't getting a lot of sympathy.
It's strange that.
Yeah,
strange
it is. That. Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's quite a nice little spot that for wild swimming, and Fife generally has quite a few of these pools. There's one at Pittenweem, Ronan at St Monan as well. Yeah. Really nice, really nice. And they have experienced a bit of a revival everywhere. We know there's the one at Tardlier. They're talking about doing lots of
Trinkies
work
Pool
there.
Outside
Trinkies Pool, yeah, exactly, Whack. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
We do have a mystery sound, which we'll let you listen to after the news. But in relation to said mystery sound, Mary got in touch a couple of weeks ago when the mystery sound was hail falling a shrub in my garden. And because we always say it's either mechanical or not mechanical. She says... If one definition of mechanical is, quotes, relating to physical forces, then this morning's mystery sound was mechanical. Please discuss, as they say in all the best essay titles. No, absolutely not. And for the purposes of this exercise, Mary, and I know you come from St Andrews, and therefore it's possibly difficult to resist this, mechanical is anything to do with machinery. Mm-hmm. Non-mechanical, you know, because then we're going to get into the rude mechanicals of Shakespeare's time in, I don't know, say, Midsummer's Night's Dream, something like that.
Sometimes you don't know where this programme's going to take you, do you?
No. And serves you right for listening to it in the first place. You get no sympathy from us whatsoever. Coming up, we're a day or two late, but it's the time of year to celebrate Imolc. And we're also going to be talking about the Stonehaven lifeboat disaster, which is being commemorated 150 years on.
Yeah, we've also got a mystery sound for you. Let's have another listen.
Right, we've had some incorrect answers so far.
Greg in Bearsden, is the mystery sound a robin singing?
Oh, a pretty laryngitic robin.
Am I doing this one? David John Chadwick in Carluke says, on another bleak day weather-wise, but one day closer to spring where he is, we'll be out and about enjoying a walk with our dogs Cassie and Charlie later. I think the mystery sound is bird-like and Antipodean.
I think, in fairness, we're one day closer to spring wherever you are.
We are. That's true.
Brody McNeil, whose chest is puffed with pride, says, as a weekly listener from Sneggy, I just had to get in touch. I never listen live, but before I go to sleep. Yeah, a lot of folk do that, actually. He says, and then he adds, I have got two mystery sounds, right? But he doesn't guess this one.
That's very good. I was speaking to a fan of the programme yesterday who says he's quite good at getting them right.
All right.
Ooh, I'm impressed because I never get them and sometimes I know the answer. Alistair and Elgin says, perhaps foolishly, I'm going to ignore your clue and say that today's mystery sound is just like a rusty old wheelbarrow which was forced into action yesterday to move some logs. Dry but windy in Elgin this morning. Fingers crossed the rain stays away.
It's that old gag, Alistair, isn't it, about the guy that got fired off the wheelbarrow went past going, because it should have been going. Right, we're going to be talking about the Festival of Imolc shortly, which fell on Thursday through into Friday. Imolc marks the halfway point between the winter solstice and the spring equinox in Neolithic Ireland and Scotland.
So does that mean that spring might be in the air? Oh, please, please. Are there any signs from our wildlife? Well, Mark visited Loch Leven Nature Reserve and met up with Warden Darren Dixon. And, of course, they were accompanied by some lovely birdsong.
Amazing the difference a bit of sunshine and blue skies make, isn't it?
I know. It just brings up all the birds, doesn't it, you know? And it just feels like a bit more spring-like today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've heard quite a lot of birds that sing around the reserve now, so a lot of blue tits and coal tits and great tits, and then the robins there. And then I had my first skylark 2 days ago as well, which was good after all that sort of frozen, windy weather we had.
Yeah.
And then all the birds are sort of, like, thinking about breeding now, so it's quite nice.
What is actually happening in the reserve at this time of year?
So we have a lot of winter and wildfowl around the loch and on the reserve, so we're kind of leaving them to it at the moment. We're not really going out and doing too much work, so we're doing lots of two bird counts a month. So we're doing our webs counts, we're counting all the sort of widgeon, teal, gadwall, mallard, you know, all the sort of birds that come along. Hooper swans as well, so we've got all the hooper swans honking about. And then the pink-footed geese are always like a feature around the loch as well. So back in October we had a count of, I think it was about 17,000.
Wow.
And that's sort of like the big influx at the start of autumn. And then they kind of disappear a bit. I think they go further south to a bit, you know, to England, places that are a bit warmer maybe. And we've still got a couple of thousand about the reserve though. So we've always got the skeins going overhead, which is quite nice.
Do you still have the same numbers?
I would say it's quite consistent what we're getting. So we're usually getting between sort of 7,000 and 12,000, sort of something around that range. It's hard to say if the numbers are going down in a reserve. I know, like, numbers have definitely increased up in at Montrose Basin, which is near Aberdeen, so...
Maybe where they're going.
Maybe their Montrose is better than here, I don't know. But, I mean, the numbers are still very high, and I guess it depends on the local conditions as well. So I think there's been quite a lot of stubble sort of fields around at the moment this year. So there's obviously a lot of good areas for them to feed. It's a lot of nice wet patches, and, you know, I think it's still quite a good place for them.
When do you expect the geese to start leaving, to start heading back north again?
I mean, the latest I've seen the geese on the reserve is maybe like late April. Probably the end of March, early April is when you sort of get... You get quite a lot of passing through as well, you know, like the ones from England and sort of further south will be passed through. But I reckon once the weather conditions are good, about that sort of time there, most of them will be off and away. It's like almost like one day there's loads of them on the reserve, you know, you might have a couple of thousand that we'll see from the cafe window in the morning, and then the next day all of a sudden you don't see any for about 6 months. So yeah. I don't really see signs. They do get quite flighty, but they're quite, I think they're maybe like itching to get away, and they've got that little instinct where they want to get back up and establish their breeding territories.
One of the things I like about this time of year is, I mean, you mentioned earlier that the skylarks start to sing. Ours started singing this last week too. But I think the song of things like robin actually changes too at this time of year. Whether it becomes fuller, richer, you know, they're trying to be a bit more of a sort of virtuoso performance, I don't know. I can't really describe it, but it feels different to me.
Yeah, well, potentially, yeah. Like, I know that I've definitely started noticing them the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and I know that they do sing all year round, and I've definitely seen a few more scraps at the bird feeders between the robins.
Yes.
So you know, like the robins,
they're actually vicious little brutes.
Oh, they are, they're very vicious, yeah, and they keep their territories all year round as well, so you'll never see a big group of robins as opposed to like a big group of finches or blue tits or something like that. Yeah. So I definitely think they're definitely growing into a sort of breeding behaviour now, I would say.
Male robins particularly, you know, they will attack each other and pick each other's heads. They can kill each other.
Yeah, they can, yeah. Thankfully, I've never seen it happen, but I have seen them rolling around on the ground, you know, and it's like, I would not like to be a robin. I'm quite glad I'm not a bird at this time of year.
Is that taking off at the moment, mallard?
Looks like a couple of mallards, yeah. They seem to like it in that little pool there.
Okay. And I don't have binoculars with me, but there's something out on the loch there. And there's a raft or something.
Yeah.
Whitish birds.
It could be golden eye. We've got... Uh-huh. So at this time of year, we did a webs count yesterday, actually, and the most numerous bird that we counted was golden eye. Uh-huh. So we've got all the males...
The tree-nesting duck. I always think that's weird.
I know, yeah. A tree-nesting duck, especially up in the... in the Highlands of Scotland, don't they? They do nests up there. But I think Nature Scot have put some sort of golden eye, potential golden eye nesting boxes around the loch. Okay. To try and bring them in. I'm not sure if they've ever been used or not, but yeah, finding sizable tree cavities is probably one of the things that sort of limits them for breeding purposes. But they've been displaying out on the loch as well. So, you know, like the males will fling their head right back. Almost looks like they're breaking their neck, you know. It's really quite disgusting to look at. But they're all trying to show off to the females before, you know. So it's quite fun to watch them.
It's just such a glorious day. I mean, the colours are so strong at this time of year, bizarrely. You know, so the water is a deep, deep, deep blue because it's reflecting the sky.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And now this big hill behind us, it's south of the reserve. Like, in December, that sun will not come above that hill line there. But now we've got a good few hours of sunlight actually coming over, and the reserve's not casting shadow anymore, which is really nice. So the birds, you know, on a day like this, like, absolutely beautiful. Teal, you know, that green wing they've got, that little feather on the wing, it's metallic, you know, it's beautiful to see them up close in this light.
I mean, I've liked birds all my days, but one of the reasons I like them particularly is they allow me to identify when the seasons are changing. You can't always rely on the weather. I mean, today, for example, if you looked out the, you know, looked out the window, you think, oh, this is beautiful, it's actually quite cold. But, you know, it still definitely feels in terms of temperature like winter. But you know, by things like birdsong, by displaying behaviour and things like that, yeah, we're getting there, we're nearly out of this.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing, isn't it? It's like, I almost like you've got like a checklist of birds that appear at the start of spring, and you know, oh, there's the first chiff-chaff singing. We're nearly, you know, usually that's sort of mid-March, and then later into March, early April, the willow warblers will start singing, and then you'll get your first swallow, which is always like a really, it's definitely spring now, you know. So, you know, I don't want to wear gloves anymore. I don't want to wear a hat anymore, you know. I'm ready for spring. So I think there's certainly a lot of signs about now, and the snowdrops are coming up in the woodlands as well. And that's always like, right, that's the first sort of wildflower of the year, so it will go quickly though, but it's coming.
Darren Dixon and RSPB Loch Leven there. Spring is on its way, that's the message this morning, and that's exactly what the Celtic Festival of Imolc is all about. Here to tell us more is Wiccan priestess and author, Dr. Rebecca Beattie. Good morning, Rebecca. Before we get to Imolc, what is Wiccan?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's a modern pagan practice. Sometimes people identify as witches, sometimes people identify as pagan. Essentially, what we are is a spiritual path that uses nature as its source for everything. So for inspiration and connection to the world, and we really watch the seasons of nature quite carefully.
So how does Imolc fit into that then?
So Imolc fits in. It's one of our Wheel of the Year festivals. So as a practice, we have a series of eight festivals that we celebrate across the year. And as I said, we watch the seasons of nature, and each one of those festivals is really celebrating something different that's happening in nature at that time. So we're encouraged to kind of go out into the woods and into the fields and up into the moorland and really see what nature's doing at the moment.
How do you do that? I mean, do you do that as individuals or as groups?
Yeah, we do it as in both, actually. You might find modern pagans that are practicing as part of a group, either a witch's coven or a druid grove, or you might be a solitary practitioner as well, or you might be both. So I'm part of a coven. Sounds a scary word, but it's not really in practice. But I'm part of a group that meets, you know, we meet up every 6 or 8 weeks or so to celebrate one of these festivals. But I also have a solitary practice that's my day-to-day living, really.
If I came across you, you know, in the wild, you know, yes, in a woodland or a moorland or whatever it was, would I necessarily know what, you know, something was going on?
Probably not. I'm a very outdoorsy person anyway. I'm very, I try to be very down to earth. And so you might come across me walking my dog across the moors or through the woods. And I might be concentrating on what's going on around me. I might be paying attention very closely. So you might see something slightly strange, like me peering at leaves or peering at plants growing under trees.
Yeah, but I do that.
But really, we're nature lovers just like everybody else, really.
Yeah,
exactly.
What are you looking for specifically? You know, when you go out, what is it you want to see?
So I tend to be watching for the signs of the seasons turning. So just like your last segment, really, I'd be looking at, for Imolc, I'll be looking out for things like the first snowdrops and the first skylarks up on the moor and what the bird life is doing and what the tree life is doing. And really just sort of, you know, getting a sense of how the season's changing.
How does Imolc fit into this? I mean, is it just a handy label that you can sort of stick on a particular time of the year?
Well, it's actually an ancient Celtic festival. It's one of... So while our Wheel of the Year practice is a pretty modern thing that's been brought together, Imolc itself, there are a number of Celtic festivals that come through the year that predate Christianity in this country. So before the Roman army brought Christianity in to the British Isles, we were, you know, various people celebrating various things across the country. And in those Celtic areas, so we're talking about obviously Scotland and Ireland and Devon and Cornwall and the Isle of Man, there would be a festival at this time of the year celebrating the first noticing of spring. So it's the first promise of spring that comes. We're not quite there yet, but we can see the signs coming, and it's that sort of moment of hopefulness, really. So it does date back a long way, but we don't always have written records of what was going on, but we can, you know, we can get a sense of it by looking at nature.
And do some people mark it in quite a ceremonial way, you know, with rituals or whatever?
Yes, absolutely. So at this time of the year, particularly on the nearest Saturday, because we're all modern pragmatists these days. So often you might find, you know, a group of pagans gathering together on an evening to perform a ritual, or in the daytime. That might be outdoors if you're a practicing druid. It might be inside in the privacy of your own home if you're practicing Wicca. But we sort of gather in different ways. I might also, on the actual day itself, if I'm lively enough to remember on that morning, I might actually go and do something out in the fields and the woods as well, just as a, you know, a sort of small marking of it out in nature.
Everything's obviously tied to nature and the countryside and the changing of the seasons, and, you know, this wheel turning, as you describe it. If this is not a daft question, why do you perform the rituals then? What's the purpose of that?
I guess it's a moment for us of expressing gratitude for what we're seeing out in nature. You know, we're all, even if you're living in a city, I think it's spending time in nature is something that really enhances your mental health and your general well-being. And it's good for nature too, if we can be respectful of what's going on there. So it's for us, it's that moment of really noticing how we interact with the world and that we're part of the environment, not just people living on it.
That's been fascinating, Rebecca. Thank you very much for your time this morning. Much obliged.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Rebecca Beattie there, Wiccan priestess and author.
Yeah, very interesting. I think more people are interested in some of these very old traditions as well.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Now, as you might know, if you've been listening, the Scottish Government has committed to creating at least one new national park, but not restricted to just one necessarily, by the end of this parliamentary term. Bids from interested areas have to be in by the end of February. Now, I've visited a few of the areas, putting the hats into the ring, Glen Affric, Lochaber, Tay Forest, Affric to Allerdale, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was my turn this week. Mm-hmm. The campaign for a Galloway National Park has been on the go for a number of years, so when this announcement was made, they were pretty much ready and waiting. I spoke to Sandra McDowell, Jordan Meredith and Rob Lucas, who told me about the area that this bid actually covers.
So we're right up in the northeast corner of the area we're proposing here, up at Loch Doon. And basically the area extends down the whole of the Dee catchment, down towards the coast, round Castle Douglas, and then around the coast on the south towards Dumfries, along that part of the coast. And to the west of here, it's really out to the coast, all the way to the west coast and the south coast. So it's across to Girvan and then right down to the south coast, finishing off at the Mull of Galloway, the most southerly point in Scotland.
It's quite rugged here, isn't it? We've got a lovely view of Loch Doon in the background. We've got some sheep wandering about. It's very, very picturesque. I have to say, you are an incredibly organised group. You have your own PR machine and you've been campaigning on this issue for a long time. Why does it mean so much to you?
I think we've been going for 7 years and we started off going out and asking the community, do you actually want a national park? And we were so amazed at the amount of feedback we got that said, yeah, we really want you to explore this, that for the last 7 years, we've been kind of making the case and then turning that kind of making the case into a campaign. And then, of course, the opportunity arose when the Scottish Government's commitment to at least one new national park to actually really press that and to really re-engage with communities again. So that's kind of where we are now. And it makes such a difference because it puts Galloway on the map. I mean, nobody really knows we're here. It's one of the things that people tell us. It's kind of like, Galloway, where's that? It's not one of those iconic places, because people just don't know it. When they come, they love it. But getting people here is what we really need to do to strengthen the local economy.
But presumably you could fund a tourism campaign and it might do that. So you must think that there will be other benefits as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been some really good initiatives in across Galloway. And by Galloway, we're actually in eastern Ayrshire and it extends into southern Ayrshire. So it's kind of like the historic kingdom of Galloway we're talking about here. But those initiatives have always run into the sand because, like all initiatives, they last 2, 3, 4 years, whatever. And then it just retreats back. We need something that gives us that permanent vision for the future of this area, which is based on the natural resources, which are so amazing, and which also just inspires people to do things. You know, you kind of go, I know it's going to be a national park. I know it's going to stay being a national park. I can commit to do something which fits with that ethos.
So you think it will attract investment, do you?
I think it will attract investment. Our calculations for tourism is it will add about £100 million a year to the core area and about another £100 million around the edge of the area. So places like Dalmellington, which is one of the kind of gateway settlements, and Castle Douglas and others, they will see that benefit as well. So, and it will also attract people to come in, both green capital, you know, investment in people wanting to help restore peat, people want to help restore our lovely woodlands. So all sorts of investment. I mean, national parks are very good, aren't they, at catching the imagination of people who are going, well, actually, that's something I can buy into. They understand what a national park is, and that's really important.
There would be restrictions as well, though. Could that be an issue in the longer term?
Yeah, all national parks have restrictions, but I mean, everywhere has restrictions, doesn't it? Ultimately, you know, there's a planning system. I think we have far fewer of the kind of issues that some of the other areas thinking of national parks are tackling, because we actually want more people to come here. We see that as an integral part of our bid, whereas many of the other bids are understandably thinking about how they can get some resource to help manage or help redistribute an already kind of very high visitor number.
You talked about having a lot of public support. Sandra, you're going to say that you've got support by the bucket load, aren't you?
You're right. Yesterday proved it. We had the second of our engagement exercises yesterday, and we had over 80 people. There were a few people who had, for various reasons, did not want a national park, but we convinced most of them, and we had a lot of people who were absolutely up for the next stage and being designated a national park, yes.
I'm intrigued by what their objections were.
Many of them were large farmers who obviously feel that they have enough regulations in their particular business at the moment. But I think we did a very good job of talking them round, and we have had some support from the Galloway Biosphere as well.
We're also joined by 16-year-old Jordan. For someone who wants to build a future here, do you think it will create employment opportunities?
100%. It's a deprived area. It's looked at as a down-low area that doesn't really have much employment. And I think it would open up more opportunities, because then there's more jobs that could open up here. There isn't just the set jobs that we always get told. There's a lot more to open up. It's just a case of exploring what we need to see.
I have worked in my community for a long time, and we have businesses struggling. We have an economy that really is quite fragile at the moment, and this will give them the support they need to grow their business. It will also attract other businesses in, and anything that is attracted in to develop whatever kind of tourism business they choose will also be available for the local community. And jobs are important. I mean, we're going through place planning at the moment, a lot of the towns in Galloway, and all are saying we need affordable housing, we need to attract families in for our schools, we now have good broadband, so it's possible to work from home. All of these things point to a secure future, and we could be an all-year-round destination, so it would mean full-time, year-long employment for people, and not just the part-time employment that we have at the moment, because some of our hotels and restaurants are only open part-time since COVID, because we don't have the visitor numbers. We're here, we're ready, and we're able to attract large numbers, and that's what we hope for.
Sandra McDowell, Jordan Meredith and Rob Lucas there. And next week I'm going to be in the Borders hearing about their bid.
Yeah. We're trying to get round them all, aren't we? If we've not been to you yet, then get in touch with us. Give us the invitation, please.
Absolutely. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Sitting right next to me here at Beechgrove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, I think we tell you this every week. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast too. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Back to the mystery sound then. Let's have another listen. Mm-hmm.
We have a wheen of correct answers so far, but these are incorrect or close enough. It says, good morning, Mark and Rachel. I'm enjoying the programme while we're in Caerphilly this morning. Ray parakeets. I visited Greenback Garden just outside Glasgow recently and was surprised to see parakeets flying about. A dog walker told me they'd been there for some time. We're in Caerphilly to go to the Wales versus Scotland game in Cardiff later today, and as townies have been delighted to awake to an owl hooting in the nearby woods. No idea what kind, though. Come on, Scotland, says Nos Gladys and Pirate Dan.
Oh, very nice. Davey from Annisland also thinks it's parakeets. It's Sue and Torfinns. Good morning. Is the mystery sound a budgerigar? I'm a bit cagey about making a fool of myself. And Geography Girl in Deeside is no better. This week's mystery sound, not sure if it's a stoat or a weasel, because weasels are weaselly identified, but stoats are totally different.
We get what we deserve sometimes, I suppose.
We do. No name on this one. I'm happily listening to the show, oblivious to the weather conditions, in the horizontal position with a cup of tea. Could the mystery sound be otter kits?
How do you do that? How do you drink a cup of tea from a horizontal position?
I mean, we spill it sitting up, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, never mind. We were talking earlier to Dr. Rebecca Beattie, author and Wiccan priestess. We managed to come off the end of her without saying what the name of her book was. It's called Wheel of the Year. Rebecca Beattie, Wheel of the Year, if you're interested in finding out more about that.
Very nice. I'm going to just quickly throw in these other guesses as well before we move on. Maeve in Inverurie says, is the mystery sound the cheeky hops on your plate starling at the Inversnakey Cafe after yesterday's walk in Aberdeen's Beach Boulevard? And Tom from Ayrshire, that little noise you've been doing this morning sounds like someone blowing in a reed of grass. Good guess.
Oh, these are good guesses.
Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give us a ring, 0808 592 9500. Now, a special appeal is being made to trace the descendants of the crew involved in the Stonehaven lifeboat disaster of 1874. Four men were killed in the tragedy which happened 150 years ago in, well, dreadful weather conditions. A service to remember all those involved will be held in the North East later this month. I spoke to Peter Essen from the RNLI in Stonehaven, who's been researching the events of that fateful day.
150 years ago, there was a tremendous storm came through the North Sea, and a number of vessels were damaged, including a vessel called the Grace Darling. She was carrying coke to the Baltics. She turned back after being damaged by the sea and came back up into the UK onto the coast around about Catalina area, was spotted by the Coast Guard as she was going north. The Coast Guard alerted the Stonehaven lifeboat that there was a vessel out there. The Stonehaven lifeboat went out with 12 people. They raised the sails and rowed out towards the vessel, and they chased the vessel from Stonehaven up towards Aberdeen. About 10 miles that they were chasing her. They left about 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go and chase her. They got to within 100 yards of her at Girdle Ness when the vessel took down her distress flags. At that point, the lifeboat decided to go into Aberdeen Harbour. They'd been battling a fairly heavy swell at the time. As they were entering the Aberdeen Harbour, the vessel was caught by the stern and her bow dug in, so she went almost vertical. She came down back onto the water properly, but she was broadside, and at that point she capsized with the next wave and everybody was thrown overboard.
That must have been absolutely terrifying.
It would have been absolutely terrifying for the people on board and also for the people who were watching. So at that point, a huge crowd had gathered down at the breakwater because news had travelled that there was a vessel coming up the coast that was in distress and being chased by the Stonehaven lifeboat. But it was absolutely terrifying for the people on board being thrown into the water. They're not as well equipped as we are today with the lifeboat. They were wearing cork life jackets. They had no proper protective clothing in the way of oilskins or dry suits, etc. It was just what they were wearing clothes-wise, as in jumpers and trousers.
So all 12 men ended up in the water. What happened next?
According to eyewitness statements, one of them appeared to be dead immediately after I was killed. Immediately the boat capsized. Six of the crew were able to hang on to the lifeboat. Two of the crew were washed ashore at Torrey Battery, one of whom did not survive, and three others were washed out to sea and were lost at sea. They were later recovered from the beaches to the north in Aberdeen up towards Merca. The six who were on board the vessel were able to right it and were then able to row into the North Pier where they were all rescued.
It sounds remarkable in a way that anyone survived, but four people did lose their lives, didn't they?
Yes, it's heartbreaking when you realise that they could possibly have been saved. Today, they most likely would have survived with the equipment that we have. The RNLI's come on a tremendous distance in the past 200 years since it was founded. And this was 150 years ago, so the RNLI was still very much in its infancy. However, having said that, the lifeboat, the St. George, was a self-righting lifeboat, which was unusual in those days to actually have a boat that could self-right.
As you say, it's 150 years ago. You're now trying to trace the descendants of those who were involved in this tragedy.
Yes. The four people who were killed, their names are well known, but we've had to do a fair bit of research to go and find the survivors' names, which we now have. And we're now putting out a search, a call, looking for people who are relatives, either those who died, but also those who survived as well, to invite them down to a memorial service here in Stonehaven on the 25th of February.
How are you getting on with that? I mean, presumably there will still be relatives who live quite close to here, if not in the town itself.
Yes, there are relatives. We have had two relatives contact us. We've actually had one from Australia, of all places, who's reached out to us. We would like to be able to reach as many people as possible to invite them down. They may have heard the story of the capsize, that it may be their father or grandfather or uncle was actually involved with the lifeboat and the St. George back in 1874. And we'd like to invite them down to actually help us commemorate the bravery of these guys.
What have you been able to find out about those who died in this tragedy?
Not a huge amount, not as much as I would like. We're able to find out the full names of all bar two people. We know the ages and the professions of the people that died. The coxswain, he was married with three children. He was 37. The rest of them were a lot younger. They were in their early 20s, late teens, early 20s.
And there's no doubt this would have had a huge impact on this community at the time.
It would have been absolutely devastating for the community to see 12 people who go out in a boat. These people wouldn't actually have climbed into the boat naturally. The wives would have been down here to physically see them and lift them onto the boats to keep them dry. And they would have waved their husbands, their fathers, their sons away on this lifeboat. Unfortunately, four of them did not come back.
Peter Essen of Stonehaven RNL either.
Yeah, fascinating, obviously tragic story as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that the effect that it has on a community, because the 1970 Fraserburgh lifeboat disaster, my uncle Johnny was coxswain of that boat and lost his life. It was about 7 or 8 years before Fraserburgh had a lifeboat after that, because mm-hmm. they were kind of gripped. They wanted the safest possible boat they could get.
Yeah.
And they argued about it before eventually they decided on one, and they thought that's fine, and they moved forward. But it yeah. took that long.
Yeah.
You know, for the people that were directly involved to sort of get over it.
Yeah, what was interesting actually with this one in 1874 is that they had a replacement lifeboat almost immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I, again, just like you were saying, I thought it would take a long time to get a replacement, but no, one appeared almost immediately. And they've got a really interesting wooden post, actually, just outside the point where you would be launching the lifeboat. Mm-hmm. And Peter was saying, you know, it's been there for more than 150 years, mm-hmm. and it, you know, it's gnarled. It looks like lots of things have been tied to it. And I think at one point they were saying, you know, we need to get rid of this. It doesn't look very good. But actually, I think the thinking now is it's hugely significant, and it probably deserves its own plaque.
I can't remember which boat it was, it might have been Peterhead, but Ewan went to record it, you know, and it was a slipway launch. Mm-hmm. So he says, where's the best place for me to stand to get the sound of this recording? And they looked at him and they went, just you stand there. He got knocked backwards into the harbour because a huge bow wave came off it and whatever. Of course, they wouldn't have known that would have happened.
No, of course
no,
not.
No.
If you have any information about the crew of the 1874 tragedy, then do get in touch with the RNLI Stonehaven Facebook page. I think that's the best way to reach them. An event will be held in Stonehaven on Sunday, the 25th of February, to remember the tragedy.
A couple of weeks ago, Rachel visited Willow Coffin Maker Karen Collins at a workshop near Forest, and a lot of people commented on the piece at the time, you know, how moving it was and what a nice idea it was. After hearing that piece, Duncan Grant from Granton and Spey got in touch to tell us about the natural burial ground he looks after. He quite rightly thought it might be something we might be interested in. So I went to meet Duncan, and my first question was, what's the difference between an ordinary cemetery and a natural burial ground?
Well, for a start, there's no gravestones. So instead, just as we're walking past here, these are, now you have an option to just get your name recorded on this frame.
So there's little plaques put up on the side of this, what have you, just with the name and date of birth, date of death. That's it.
But everybody's given GPS location, and they're also given what three words, mm-hmm. So that if anybody wanted to come and actually go to the grave, then they could.
See, I'm just trying to get my sense of the geography here. I would say the river, the Spey, is that way. This, once upon a time, would have been the bed of a much wider Spey. Because, I mean, this is an old river bed, yes, where we're standing at the moment. So the trees either side, but this is an open space in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a nice woodland spot.
It's just a lovely spot. Well, the last farmer at Delifour, Davy had his cattle in here because they had the shelter. And there's also the burn at the far end.
Okay. And how did you get involved in this? What is your position?
Well, I have the fantouche name of custodian, but it just means I'm the caretaker. Uh-huh. I was working part-time with one of the local undertakers, the custodian at that point, and he wasn't very well and he was wanting to retire. Uh-huh. And he said to me, do you know anybody who would like to do this? And I said, well...
Me?
Aye, you know.
And who chooses to come to a place like this? Why do they do it?
They do it because it's, I suppose, it's more biodegradable here. You know, we're not, like, nobody, you can't get buried here if you've got metal handles on your coffin. Right. You know,
No brasswork, nothing like that.
We don't even allow flowers with oasis. Uh-huh. You know, things like that. It all has to be biodegradable.
Okay. So anything that come here has to be able just to sort of disappear naturally over time.
That's right.
There's a marker there in amongst the trees.
That's right. There are several areas here, Mark. This areas here are known as the glades. Uh-huh. And then further up, there's the bank, the Speyview Bank. And then we have three areas of woodland.
So folk come here with... either unadorned wooden coffins or wicker coffins,
yep.
Or possibly no coffins at all.
Well, that's right. That hasn't happened to me. they've all been some form of wood, but the, or cardboard. Yeah. You know?
Cardboard?
Aye, it's a cardboard kind of, aye, stiff cardboard.
Aye, we need to be stronger.
Aye.
Aye. So when folk come to pick their spots, what do? They just kind of wander about and think, I kind of like the look of that.
Aye. I mean, I guess there was a local family came out here, September maybe, and the lady had been in my class in school, and so her son and her husband came out, and the sun was shining, and they said, can we go there? I've got a book with all the, obviously, you know, where everybody is. So, that space was free, so we just booked it. So, I mean, so that family know now that, you know, when it's a bonny day, the sun will be shining on that particular grave through the trees, you know? And it's a nice thing. You know, it's quite a... I feel a bit privileged to be out here, you know, because I don't meet anybody sad. Everybody that's coming out here has kind of... They're facing death in a different way, you know. I mean, the most of what I do, actually, is pre... It's not like I'm selling anything, but I meet people out here, and they pick where they're going to go. You know, there are more plots reserved than there are occupied out here.
This doesn't feel to me like a business. It doesn't, you know, there must be a business model to this, but it doesn't feel to me like a business.
Well, no, but I mean, I work for a company. We have 10 sites in the UK, with 3 in Scotland.
Yeah. The point I'm making is that this doesn't have the feel to me of somewhere that would have sufficient throughput to make economic sense.
No, well, that's right. Yeah, because I mean, it's not busy.
You know, few cemeteries are.
No, it's not. You know, what's the expression? I'm nae hard card.
No, exactly. No.
We just got this laid in November because it was real boggy in here.
I can see marker posts.
Aye, there was one. There was a funeral in here in early December.
That's nearly 2 months ago. So that's about the sort of the regularity of it, about once every 2 months or so?
Yeah, well, like 2 in December. But no, I'd... What did I have? 11 last year. See, so there was a... This here was the last one that was in here. This was in... First week in
this
December.
Spot here.
This spot just here.
See, you wouldn't even realise there was a burial site here at all. No. I see the edge there,
that's
almost
right.
A turf.
That's
but that's
right.
That. I would have walked past that without noticing
right.
It.
Yeah, I mean, come April, May, it's gone. You'll not see that again. Yeah. You know.
This is going to sound really weird. This is the kind of place I would come to spend time.
Aye.
You know, just to sort of sit and think and you know, thermos flask of coffee, something along
that's
those
right.
Lines.
Aye. You know. It's a very pleasant place to be in, like May, you know, in springtime. I'll come out here about 7 o'clock in the morning and just sit with a bacon roll, you know. And, it is pleasant, you know.
Duncan Grant there, lovely bloke.
Lovely turn of phrase.
Oh, just fantastic, a nae hard card. That was the Delafour Natural Burial Ground near Granton-on-Spey.
Yeah, sounds like a lovely place, actually.
Yeah, there's something about it that really appeals to me, and certainly that, you know, that gravesite that's, what was it, beginning of December, I think he said it was. So we're talking a couple of months, practically invisible in the landscape.
Yeah.
That appeals to me, too, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but if you want to, you can get the GPS coordinates or what three words or whatever it is and go and stand in the right place.
Yeah. But yeah, I like the story about the people who arrived and went, I can see the sun here, this is the spot for me.
Yes.
That's nice, a nice way to decide.
Sun's, you know, shining through the trees in a particular spot on a particular day, so you would know.
Yeah.
You know, if there's no cloud cover, you're going to get that. And there is a spot further along, which I think they call it the Spey View.
Okay. Is that how they market it?
I'm not sure he was actually viewing the Spey from that position, but you know, the attendance and things like that. Anyway.
Oh, very nice. Earlier, we heard about work to restore the Sellardike tidal pool in Fife. Now, every day at about 7:30, a wild swimmer who lives close to the water puts out a message on a group chat informing other enthusiasts about whether or not it's a good day for a dip.
Rachel was in luck when she visited a few weeks ago. A very hardy bunch turned up ready to hit the very chilly water. Sadly, heartbreakingly, she'd forgotten her dookers.
You have got the most fantastic name for a swimming group. Who are you?
We're the Nairichters.
The Nairichters. Now, how did you come up with that?
Linda, you? How did
yes, I did. It's just a term for somebody that's a bit daft. And that's us.
And we live up to it.
So how long have you been doing this?
For me, almost 3 years. In April, I started doing it. Well, I tried to do it every day, but it's tailed out to about two or three times a week now.
And what do you get out of it?
Oh, it's great. Everything about it. I mean, you don't realise at the time, but you do get such a hit for the cold water, first of all. And then there's also the social aspect, which is so important for all us, just to talk about things. And that's a huge part of it as well.
Is it a bit of a thought when you just first open your eyes thinking in a few minutes you'll be heading in there?
The first thing you want to do is press snooze. But you know what? It's something to get you up in the morning, it really is. And just this bunch of crazy women make it all worthwhile. Just we have so much fun and hilarity.
Here's a late arrival. She's about to get in as well.
Late arrival. I pressed the snooze button too many times this morning.
And how long have you been doing this for?
I've been doing it for 5 years. I'm in London and up and here.
And how does this compare to other places that you've done it? Because, of course, you've got your own tidal pool here.
Well, this is way and above anywhere else because it's so beautiful. And it's right in the heart of nature. Yeah.
It's safe. We all know where we can go in. We're really comfortable here. You get views and sunrises like you get nowhere else. Not that we're biased.
And it's actually incredibly sheltered here. You know, it was quite windy when we're standing on the road, but you get a shelter. Here it's quite good.
Yes, definitely. And a lot of people like the fact that we've got the coloured pegs because you can hang your jackets up. So they're not on the ground when you're getting changed.
That's quite a nice luxury, isn't it? You've got pegs attached
like
to the
wall. This when it's raining. Mm-hmm. You can hang your jackets up and you can cover your seats so they don't get wet when you're in the pool.
I'm aware that the longer I blather here, the colder you're going to get. So I'm going to let you get in. Just before I do that, tell me your names.
Marjorie.
Linda.
Elsie.
Eleanor.
Christine.
Margaret.
Brilliant. And I'll count you back out again.
Let's go, girls.
This is the bit that you have to be most careful about, particularly if it's covered with water, which we don't go in a lot at high tide. There are a lot of crevices. We would love to see this all getting made a bit more safe.
Yeah, quite a few holes in the rocks just as you head down.
Linda's our duck the day because we didn't have our duck for the temperature, do we, Linda?
We normally have a wee duck that tells us how cold it is. But we didn't have one.
Tropical, Linda.
Wouldn't you go that far?
Right. That means it's freezing.
That means.
It's my feet. I test by my feet. Oh, on my knees.
Uh-huh.
And oh.
And everything.
Oh, I tell you.
Are you away?
My two right gloves are good.
Right.
Oh,
here we go.
Find your Oh!
Oh, Tam, it's really cold! Right, come on, girls.
And this is how it
headlines.
I'm at the coos tail.
Are you looking forward to this?
It's my subconscious resistance.
How does it feel as you hit the water?
It's honestly invigorating, it really is. And your skin just goes, oh my goodness!
They're all sticking quite close together. None of them are wearing wetsuits, so there's lots of bare skin. They do have on thick woolly hats though, and they're just such a happy bunch. All you can hear is chatter and laughter. How are you feeling, ladies?
We're doing fine.
Fine.
You're coming out. How do you feel now?
Well, coming out's actually not so bad because usually the air temperature's slightly warmer than the... Yeah. Today it's about the same. But you know, this does mean a lot to me because my mum and dad learnt to swim in this pool. And, you know, every time I go in it, I always think of them. Well, they called it the pond, Silladyke Pond. All the community used to come here at the weekends or school holidays, and it was always buzzing. And so it started being a bit like that in the summer holidays. But we're just the Ní Richters that swim every day in the winter.
But happy, happy associations for you.
Yes, it meant a lot to me. I started off on my own, just swimming, and then Margaret and Linda said, could they come with me? And it just grows and grows and grows, you know.
Absolutely terrific. And do you feel that this has set you up for the day?
Oh, yes. I'm away to work now for a wee while, and I'm buzzing. I'll be buzzing.
We all say that we regret if we don't come, but we never wish that we hadn't come, you know what I mean?
You've got a hot water bottle there. That looks very sensible.
A hot water bottle and little hand pebbles.
Oh, clever.
These were a game changer. An absolute game changer. In the hot water bottle, you can put your feet in. You know, like a little penguin.
Oh, you're all very well prepared.
Because we sit for about 2 hours after the swim.
Blethering.
Yeah.
It's only the blethering that we come for, girls, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the chat. How are you feeling now you're out?
I just feel so good. I just think it's invigorating, just sets you up for the day. Yeah, maybe didn't look my best, but I don't care. I don't care.
I think you
look
very
glad. Hat on. Get my woolly hat on. And I've still got my lippy on, so there we go.
The very hardy Ní Richters of Silladyke there.
Oh, it's just a cracking
name. They were cracking.
I love those ladies. They're brilliant. Uh-huh. It would encourage anyone to give wild swimming a go.
But not you, clearly.
Look, I would have done, but I had other things to do that day.
Don't give us it. You'd have been even more alert had you actually got and done it.
Maybe. I mean, it was blooming cold, I have to say. It was really, really cold.
We were up in Orkney a couple of years ago, up near Bursay, and it was a terrible, terrible day. I mean, just awful, you know, driving wind and rain and what have you. And we saw this solitary lassie, you know, and she's got the swimming costume on and boots and, I had like neoprene boots and a woolly tammy. Mm-hmm. Well, and I was with my pal Ian Menny, and I said, right, come on, I need to go and talk to this lassie. I've got some recording gear in the car and what have you. And he says, you can't just go up and talk to a strange woman. And I said, Ian, it's what I do. He said, what? You just go and talk to her. And it was a real light bulb moment for him because he thought, you can go and talk to anybody about anything.
Well,
I said,
you can.
Pretty well.
You can. And, you know, if they're daft enough to be getting into freezing cold water,
they bring
they're
it on
very
themselves.
Much for us. Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. No, they were great, great fun. Time to reveal our mystery sound now. Shall we have a final listen?
Go for it. Just a few more incorrect answers before we get to the correct one and what have you. It says, Ruth and Dogbeauty says, can't remember who on radio said that it's the female robins that sing in the winter, males in spring, and each have different tones. Don't know about that, Ruth. We'll find out about that, though.
Yeah. You were alluding to different song, though, earlier, weren't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Sheena Parker in Aviemore. I think it's a red... What's that?
Hoopoo.
Hoopoo bird. Oh, very good.
And it's one with a sort of crest thing on the back.
Oh, yes. You know. Okay. She says, I have an electric bike, and I think it's great.
Okay. Phil and Lil say, good morning from Forrest. The wee Yorkie pup is convinced the mystery sound is a rodent of some kind, possibly a guinea pig. The labs aren't convinced. Enjoying the programme as usual.
And Meg says, it's somebody blowing a Burns bird whistle. You think?
No. Helen McDonald got the correct answer. He says, I'm thinking it must be a macaque. Brackets, the macaque.
Yeah, it's had an incredible amount of publicity there.
Tremendous, absolutely tremendous. I mean, it's just 2 weeks ago I was at the Highland Wildlife Park. I mean, obviously a Japanese macaque escaped from there. And, I mean, it was national coverage.
Yeah. And I like all the takes on it on social media as well. And yeah. It's wearing a kilt and you name it.
Ross and Tainault said, is the mystery sound of Japanese macaque refusing to return to captivity, having found freedom in the Scottish countryside? It is. Jock Wood says, is the mystery sound that of a sauntering Japanese macaque enjoying a wee sojourn in the Kinyusi parish? He's bobbing about in the North Sea for another 6 days, he says.
Richard and Mandy in Exeter have got it right. Doogie and Anya in Cooper, they get it right too, saying it's that cheeky monkey that was on the loose laughing at you. Probably too windy for Anya's wild swimming today, but we'll walk instead along the beach.
Frida from Falkirk says, my guess is Honshu, the Japanese monkey, and being recaptured and complaining about missing beef to go with the Yorkshire pudding he was found eating. See, that's it. You couldn't write that. You couldn't write that.
No, you couldn't.
A Japanese macaque escapes from a Highland Wildlife Park and ends up eating a Yorkshire pudding.
Heather from Linlithgow, Arthur and Joyce on the Isle of Bute, David in Dingwall, John in Glasgow, Stuart and Elgin, Rona from Linlithgow, and Chris in Murrayshire all getting it correct. Jake from Dalkeith says, could it be a Japanese monkey experiencing his first taste of freedom?
Yes.
Yeah, it's all come to an end now for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My eldest daughter used to live back to back with a wildlife park down near Stirling. And she was out walking the dog one time, and the dog suddenly went on full alert. You know, and there was this thing screeching at it and what have you. And it was one of those little. You call those things again? They're in the adverts.
Oh, meerkats?
Meerkats, yeah. That's the one I'm after. It was a meerkat that
Aww.
Had escaped. And she talked
so cute.
She talked to the owner, you know, happened to bump into him and said, you haven't lost. And he said, have you seen a meerkat? It had been getting bullied, poor thing.
So cute. I love them.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. There is no midweek podcast this week, so there's no point looking for it. Because
you've been slacking, I think.
I've been slacking. I think it must be me. You can listen back to our archive on BBC Sounds. From all of the team here in BBC Aberdeen, however, thank you very much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.